Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher.
Earlier this month, in a speech in Moscow, a prominent political figure named Alina Kabayeva provided what is perhaps the best explanation we've had recently of Russia's thinking about the strategic importance of information. Information work today, she said, in the conditions in which we live and fight for our country is like a weapon of war. It's as important as the Kalashnikov rifle. Let's work. Kabayeva's comments are noteworthy because she's no ordinary propagandist. The 39-year-old former gymnast and parliamentarian is widely known to be Russian President Vladimir Putin's longtime girlfriend. And she's also chairman of the board of the National Media Group, Russia's largest private media holding company. In other words, Kabayeva is arguably the country's most symbolic propagandist. And her comments provide an important insight into how Russia's government sees propaganda, disinformation, and media manipulation. That fact still isn't adequately appreciated in the West. Over the past year, the U.S. and its partners in Europe have rallied together to oppose Russia's military aggression against Ukraine. And in Washington and European capitals, there's a growing awareness of the need to tackle Russia's malign political influence. But unfortunately, an accurate understanding of where precisely information fits into that equation has lagged pretty far behind. It's a problem that I wanted to discuss with Ivana Stradner, one of the country's leading specialists on Russian information warfare and cybersecurity. Ivana is currently a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and she's testified before the European Parliament and briefed various government officials and agencies here in the U.S. about Russian strategy and strategic communications. That makes her the perfect person to help us unpack how Moscow manipulates the media sphere and precisely what the U.S. and Western governments should do about it. Ivana, wonderful to have you on.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
All right. So for openers, I think a tutorial is in order. Can you explain to the audience how Moscow views information and why the Kremlin has come to see it as so crucial to its foreign policy and its strategic objectives?
Absolutely. So first of all, let me be very clear that for the Russian Ministry of Defense, they consider information as the weapon. Indeed, even Russian Minister of Defense openly declared that information has become a weapon. So one other thing that I want to emphasize is that they do pay a lot of attention to information warfare because it's a great asymmetric tool for the Russian military to challenge the West. I always like to emphasize that they do not need to roll on tanks in Brussels, London, or Washington. All they really need to do is to use information as a weapon to destabilize the West. And while everyone started paying attention to Russian information warfare in 2014 during their information warfare in Ukraine, actually, this is a very, very old tool. And I know that you've been talking with other people on your podcast about the history of Russian information warfare and how Moscow actually used that during the Cold War through active measures, even to destabilize the United States. So let me be clear that this is really, really nothing new. What is new is technology, because that helps information to flow much faster in Russian countries where they have interest to destabilize. I want to tell you, we really don't need to just make anything like a conspiracy theory because the Russian military actually openly even talks about this. I mean, Putin openly stated that for Russia, Russian responses must be based on what he called like intellectual superiority. He stated that they will be asymmetric and less expensive. Then, for example, you really just need to read Russian military strategists who openly talk that in an ongoing revolution in information technologies, information and psychological warfare will largely lay the groundwork for victory, which really means who has informational superiority is going to win the war. And even the chief of the staff of the Russian military claimed that he valued non-military to military measures 4-1, which really tells you all you need to know how much Russian military values information warfare. Back in 2021, Russia adopted a national security strategy, which was a critical document. But one thing that I noticed over there was that for the first time, they devoted a separate chapter on information security. And while everyone, you know, in the West was focusing on its content related to cybersecurity, and some people are even confused, how come there is not even a word cybersecurity? Let me put other things in a perspective that in the Russian military, they do not even use the cybersecurity. They call information security, and it's not a question of semantics or translation. It's the question how they view it. For example, they consider information security from two different perspectives. One is what we call here cybersecurity on a technical side, for attacks on an electric power grid, for example. But then also in the second part of information security is cognitive warfare, psychological warfare, the use of information to destabilize the countries. And, you know, you really also just really need to look like how the Russian Ministry of Defense even defines information war. So I'm going to read his definition, which claims that war is the confrontation between two or more states in the information space with the goal of inflicting damage to information systems, processing resources, as well as to critically important structures, undermining political, economic, and social systems, carrying out mass ecological campaigns in order to destabilize society and the government. This really, really tells you all you need to know how Russia perceives information security. And that's something that we in the West oftentimes misunderstand, thinking, you know, that the world revolves around London, Brussels, and Washington.
Well, I think this is extremely important to highlight because there tends to be a pretty significant disconnect between our understanding of Russian objectives and motivations and what they're actually trying to do. And in the American context, that's probably understandable given the fact that the US public mostly became aware of Russian disinformation in the context of domestic politics, in the context of the 2016 elections and the more recent 2020 ones. And as a result, there's this tendency to see disinformation here in the US mostly through a domestic political lens. And also to assume that Moscow is simply trying to pick winners and losers in American politics, but that's not really correct. So talk for a minute about what the Russian objectives are in this use of cognitive warfare, in this use of non-military but enormously destabilizing tools.
I mean, as you can really just see, even from the clear definition that you can find on the Russian Ministry of Defense website, they openly talk about, you know, the stabilizing society and the government. They also talk in their documents about defensive measures when it comes to information security, information operations, defending Russia, for example, from the Western attacks on their spiritual and moral values and what they call like our threats on Russian secession. However, what you just mentioned here is really something Russia has been doing, which is offensive information operations in the West. And I'm always shocked and appalled how people in the West think, you know, that Russia is particularly trying to pick certain, you know, politicians that are more pro-Russian. And then, you know, they blame each other, which is exactly what Putin wants. There is another concept less known in the West, which is called reflexive control. It's an old Soviet concept, foreign to most Americans, which basically says that it's interfering in other countries' decision-making until the government is compelled to take actions in Russia's interest. So Russia is deliberately making sure that we here in the United States, we fight each other, both Democrats and Republicans, and we are being reflexively controlled by the Kremlin, not even knowing that what we are doing, which is the best gift really for Putin. Because on one side, yes, that is true, you know, that Russia has been investing in the far right in the United States, but also in the far left. And the problem is that, you know, here, what you just mentioned, you know, that we use that as a domestic tool, as a domestic debate to fight with each other, instead of claiming that we all have a mutual enemy, a foreign enemy, sitting in Moscow in the Kremlin. So we are just doing a favor to Russia.
I think that's exactly right. And I want to stay on this for a minute because I think it's an extremely important point. I've been traveling a lot in recent months in Europe, and throughout my conversations, you know, all over the continent, I was really struck by how much Europeans as a whole see Russian disinformation as an external phenomenon, and how, at least for Europe, the 2014 annexation of Crimea that you mentioned served as what you might call ground zero for a reconception and a new and more serious approach to the Kremlin. Unfortunately, though, that shift went largely unnoticed here in the United States because of all the things that I mentioned. And the practical consequence has been that the US and Europe are, you might say, misaligned in their respective approaches to Russian propaganda and disinformation. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I think, you know, it's not only that we are misaligned with Europe in terms of approaches on how to respond, but even how to define things, because even institutions that exist or were supposed to exist in the United States to fight foreign influence operations focus mostly on domestic issues. And that's the problem. That's exactly, you know, what I just mentioned earlier, how Russia is reflexively control us. Russia understands very well that here in the United States, everything is considered like from two different lenses. Either you are with me or you are against me. Either you are a Democrat or you're a Republican. There is no like a mutual consensus and among all those questions related to guns, related to abortion, like related to all those very controversial questions for both parties. So Russia understands that, and that's why they've been investing in both sides equally, which really leads me to an additional argument. If we want to really fight Russia in the information space, we have to understand how they are doing that, about their tools, how they define things, and their goals, which is really to polarize the United States. And we should not help them by fighting, you know, with each other. So I really hope that at some point we'll have someone who will put both parties on the center and to declare that we do have a mutual enemy sitting in Moscow, sitting in Beijing, doing exactly information operations using the same tool to polarize. So we should not help them.
Listen, you're singing my song, because I really have come to the conclusion that in order to build a sustainable disinformation response mechanism, you have to have buy-in from the left and the right. It can't be a partisan political issue. It has to be something that you have governmental unity over and you have continuity of government over. But let me move from here to talk about something slightly related, which is the Balkans. You're Serbian by birth, so I know this is an issue that's near and dear to your heart. But the fact is, you know, most Americans don't know Balkan politics at all. They don't follow them. They don't really understand the moving parts and the players. And so they don't really understand that the region is in play from an information warfare perspective. But you do. So tell us a little bit about what's happening in Belgrade and how the Russians are playing a role there as well.
So I always like to make jokes that the Americans don't know about the Balkans until a new war erupts over there. And the Balkans, and especially Serbia, it serves a very important function for Russia. Because what we are seeing right now in Ukraine, the Balkans and Moldova and a few other regions were supposed to serve as a backup plan for Russia in the context of Ukraine, to distract the West. Putin never wanted to occupy the Balkans or Serbia. He couldn't care less about the region. But it was a wonderful tool for him to destabilize the Balkans, so the West pays more attention there instead of focusing on Ukraine. And how does Serbia play this role? Through religion, because Russia claims that Orthodox Christianity is aligned with Russian Brotherhood. Putin understands very, very well that religion plays a tremendously important role in the Balkans, and through the Serbian Orthodox Church and different rallies, he was able to destabilize the Balkans through Serbia. Putin also has been investing tremendously in energy. So Serbia is, for example, very dependent on Russia in that sense. Russia has been also investing in sports. Russia also needs right hooligans who are going to contribute to those rallies. So this has been a very active campaign over the past 10 years. Serbia has also hosted numerous Russian media, such as RT or Sputnik, for example. Both have offices in Serbia. Serbia has very close ties, you know, with Russian military as well. Serbia hosted numerous Russian military exercises. They even put like S-400 for a military drill, even though we know that it's banned. that it can cause like a sanctions from the United States. Right now, what's happening in Serbia is fascinating because the president of Serbia has been playing this game, balancing between East and West, and Ukraine apparently ruined his plans. So now he has to decide, you know, where to go and how to go. So he did not, for example, impose sanctions on Russia. So he's still, you know, trying to play the game. And he is also trying to portray himself in the same time as a source of stability in the region, while in fact, he's the one who is destabilizing Montenegro and Bosnia, for example, and Kosovo. And Putin knows that balancing strategy. Putin is certainly not happy. So he's putting like additional effort over there. So I'm really not happy, you know, what I see in Serbia, but this is a larger context of the Balkans that we can talk about.
Yeah, let's do that, because it strikes me that that model that you laid out sounds very familiar to those people that know the pernicious shaping effects of Russian investments, of Russian involvement in culture and society in foreign countries. Is that happening in other places as well? What are you seeing elsewhere in the region in terms of Russia and its allies shaping the political environment?
Absolutely. So Putin understands very well that the Balkans is very prone to destabilizing through information operations, for example. You just need to use the religion, like, for example, what's happening right now in Kosovo with monasteries and the stabilization over there. It's a wonderful tool for Russia to play this game and to, along with its allies in Serbia, to project instability over there, to put NATO on the defensive and to show that NATO is a paper tiger, because there is apparently a peacekeeping mission, NATO peacekeeping mission in Kosovo. But it's not only Kosovo, it's also Bosnia with a tripartite presidency with different religion. Like you have Muslims, you have Catholics, and you have Orthodox Christians. And Republika Srpska, through Milorad Dodik, has played a tremendously important role because he threatened with secession last year, right before the invasion, which was also the part of Russian strategy to destabilize Bosnia and to start secession and to distract the West from what's happening in Ukraine. But there is also something that I'm very concerned about, Montenegro, which is NATO member state, that Russia already influenced multiple times. Even when they wanted to join NATO, they organized a failed coup d'etat. They strategically care about Montenegro because of its access to the Adriatic Sea. But now they are using actually the Orthodox Church and absolutely Ilan, the same strategy that they used in Ukraine between two different churches. When they split, they're doing exactly the same thing in Montenegro through the Serbian Orthodox Church. And we'll have elections in March in Montenegro. So they are already setting informational conditions for destabilization on Telegram and other channels promoting their favorite candidates. So the Balkans is really, really not in a good place. I have to tell you, I was very concerned about the Balkans in 2021 when people did not pay that much attention to Russia. I have to give credit when it's due. So finally, the United Kingdom and the United States, but also the European Union, they do pay attention to what's happening in the Balkans. I don't know, you know, how effective this will be in the end, because Vučić is definitely buying time, counting on American elections next year and this war, you know, to move on. So we'll see. But at least, you know, I see certain efforts by the West to try to discipline Russia in the region, but it's not easy.
No, that's fascinating. And it really, I think, hammers home the point how much this is a sort of a rolling process. It's a game that's in motion for the Russians and for Russia's ideological fellow travelers. And, you know, I think this really brings us very naturally to the disorganized state of U.S. strategy. And in your writings and your social media, you've been something of an evangelist for a more robust, more aggressive U.S. strategy to counter disinformation. So let's talk about that a little bit, because I'd love to hear your thoughts on what more the United States can do to punch back against adversaries like Russia in the information space.
So first of all, let me tell you why I believe in what I believe. I'm a huge fan of Ronald Reagan's strategy on information warfare, when the United States had a more aggressive and offensive strategy to win hearts and minds in Eastern Europe, where they used American soft power in terms of American jazz music or American modern art to win hearts and mind in Eastern Europe. It's needless to say also how Radio Free Europe and the Voice of America played a crucial role in my family during Milosevic's time. So this is, you know, why I think that United States should pay more attention to all those things, because after the Cold War, we stopped doing information operations in the way that we did back during the Cold War. Now, the problem is that after the end of the Cold War, we developed more like a defensive measures to protect ourselves, certainly from foreign interference, but we stopped doing that in the way that we did during the Cold War. And this is why it matters. I firmly believe that we should put Russia, because we are talking now today about Russia, even though we can use a similar strategy for China or Iran, to put them on the defensive. So they spend their time, energy, and resources defending themselves from our information operations. And look, by no means I think that we should spread disinformation in any of those countries, because the truth is on our side, but we actually missed so many opportunities. I'll just give you a very concrete examples. Like CSTO, when they threw Armenia under the bus, when they did not help their ally against Azerbaijan, we should have used that as a great opportunity to spread information to every Russian ally, telling them, you know, what it means to be a Russian friend and how Russian Brotherhood and Orthodox Christians actually, that there is no like Russian Brotherhood. Then the second thing is, for example, Russia has been peddling even here disinformation about biolabs that they claim, you know, that we train migratory birds, you know, they claim that we used bioweapons using drones. The latest thing that they claim that we used bioweapons as an ethnic weapon against the Slavic people, where we use like COVID labs tests to use DNA. And look, this is nothing new, because Russia ran a very similar campaign during the Cold War, talking about the United States developing and engineering HIV. They recently also accused us of monkeypox. So what should we do? I think it would be a wonderful opportunity for the United States, for example, to declassify some Cold War information on Russian bioweapons and to tell the world the truth about Russian maybe playing with smallpox. I recently read a wonderful interview by someone who was in the Soviet Union working on Russian biological weapon programs, and that person is currently in the United States. He gave an interview like 30 years ago. Why don't we invite that person in every media to talk about Russian biological weapons program? We do not need to really peddle lies. When it comes to Russian information space, I think, you know, that there is still an opportunity for us to penetrate into Russian information space, even though it's not easy, because nowadays, if you call, for example, in Russia, even to use the word war instead of special military operation, you can end up in prison. And Russia banned numerous social media platforms. Nevertheless, you know, it's still technologically possible to do that. And I think, you know, what we should do, we should use something that will resonate with Russians. The problem is that the rise of nationalism is so high inside Russia, tremendously high. So it will be very difficult to appeal to Russian to change their mind. And I think we should use nationalism against itself. For example, to appeal to those people and to tell them, because they care about having a great Russia, that Russia would have been a great Russia, but Putin actually with a weak military and with poor performance in Ukraine is degrading Russian greatness. The second thing, and this is something that Russia hates more than anything else, is to be mocked and to use humor and to use satire, because that's how you put them on the defensive. For example, this year, Russia will mark 70th anniversary of Stalin's death. And unfortunately, I read recently data, more than 50% of Russians believe that Stalin was a great leader. So you need to appeal to them. And the way that I would go about this, I would actually use all those jokes from the Cold War era to remind every Russians of all those jokes, because it's like a double thinking inside Russia. People know all these things that we are talking, but they cannot talk about those things. And even, you know, back then during the Cold War, you had people who were sitting and inside family talking about those jokes and mocking Russian leaders. So I always like to say, let's help them and not allow Russia to rewrite history.
That's a great place to end. Ivana, thank you so much for the ideas and also for the explanation.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.